okay, actually there were teachers. I don't know that there was one teacher that, probably 2 years was the most any one teacher stayed. In the 1930s, they probably made between $700 and $900 a year. And if you had to drive very far to get to, like, you lived in LeGrand and drive out, and that ate up some of the profit. So it wasn't a high-paying job, although in those days, a dollar a day for a lot of people was probably a pretty good salary, too. But anyway, I don't remember the exact grades, probably, but some of my teachers were Mrs. Thompson, and I'll get that first name for you. And in fact, she's the one I can still communicate with, and she lives in Pendleton, and of course is retired over there. Another one was Agnes Beck, who in later years she lived out in the Connolly Warehouse area in this valley. She's gone now. Another one was Teresa Geidelhuber, and then she married a Sanderson, and it's part of the Sanderson family that Sanderson Springs in the Somerville area is named after. And in fact, she just died in the last 2 or 3 years.
How do you spell that last name?
S-A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N.
Geidelhuber?
Geidelhuber. I'm going to try. And she had a sister, Elsie, that taught in Greenwood for years, too. G-E-I-T-L-E-H-U-B-E-R.
Hmm.
And they were both teachers, and I don't know whether they are families from LeGrand area, or I would have guessed they probably both were educated at East Northern University. But anyway, they both became teachers. There's more to the family. And in fact, Elsie Geidelhuber taught at Greenwood, and with an aunt of mine, my dad's sister, Nell Young Thacker. And I remember when I was going to Greenwood School, my brother and I moved into Greenwood School in, I believe, 1945, because they decided that we needed to go to a school that was had a little more social aspect to it, and these two country farm boys needed a little more exposure. And plus, I don't think there are all that many girls in Mount Glen School, so they want us to have a different kind of experience. So we moved into LeGrand Schools, and then Dale was in the fifth grade and I was in the sixth grade, and by the end of that year, the Mount Glen School actually started sending their students all into the LeGrand school system. And I don't know whether consolidation occurred right then or not, but certainly all of the kids out of the Mount Glen School District ended up traveling, riding a school bus into LeGrand by the time I started the seventh grade.
Now, in the teachers in those schools, were they unmarried women?
Some were unmarried and some weren't.
So that was the time when it was all right to be married?
It was okay to be married. Mm-hmm. Agnes Beck was married, for example. Teresa Geidelhuber was not. I had a cousin of mine teach there about 1 year, and her name was Lucille Thacker, and she later became Krauser. And that name, C-R-O-U-S-E-R, is a family name out of Elgin that's been there for a long time. Her husband was Lyle Krauser. So I had her for a year. I think I was third grade.
Were they strict?
They were fairly strict, but you had a lot of freedom in the classroom. But you're supposed to raise your hand to get attention. But one of the things you learned in a one-room classroom, and I wanted to remember to say this, is that you learn to concentrate, because if you're going to need to do some reading or you need to do some math in the class, you've got potentially seven other grades going on, and the teacher has to be working verbally with one grade at least. And so you've got all of it. There's this dull roar going on all the time. No shouting, no playing. I mean, people are at task, but there's constant discussion going on. And dialogue, okay? And the teacher's going to be asking questions. You know, maybe it's a history lesson, and she's going to ask questions to see if they studied that. And, well, what do you think of this? Or how would you analyze this? Or what's the next step in doing this math problem?
Hmm.
And so you had to learn to concentrate. So I learned to concentrate so well that to this day, it's hard for people to get my attention if I'm reading.
Hmm.
One time at home, I remember as a kid, and this probably, by then, I was probably eighth or ninth grade, my mother was wanting me to do something. She's trying to get me to do something to help out. And I'd keep saying, I was reading a book. And I'd say, she'd hardly get my attention. So, and I'd say, well, I'll do it pretty quick, Mom. And so I kept doing this. And so she got irritated at me. And so she started saying, Jerry, you got it. And I wasn't hearing her. So finally, here's this wet dish rag in my face. Well, I wasn't very happy about it, but she got my attention. But to this day, I really can concentrate if I focus on something. Hmm. Noise typically doesn't bother me. I can watch TV and have, you know, and get so focused on it, nothing around me that I'm aware of goes on.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So, anyway, where were we?
You're in Greenwood School now.
Okay, I'm in, and by the time we were in the sixth grade, we were in Greenwood School. I wanted to say that back in Mount Glen School, that when you played, you learned to play with all ages of kids. And so but we did a lot of wrestling and stuff like this. But if some tough kid came along and really wanted to play roughhouse, then the bigger boys would see that he kind of got beat up on a little bit, so that he wouldn't be beaten up on the little kids. And he'd learn pretty fast that you can wrestle, but you have to wrestle in fun. You don't get mad, and you don't try to beat the other guy. You try to win, but you try to be on top. But the big kids looked out for the little kids is kind of what the point I want to get after. And I grew up with Bill Livingston, for example, who was several years, probably 4 or 5 years older than I am. But we played together. You didn't have that many kids to play with. Mm-hmm. And Bill died just a year or so ago, and his wife Elaine still lives on the family property out there. But he's one of those I remember being my protector, and Dale, my brother's protector, from the rough-out kinds of kids. When you went into Greenwood, we discovered that, first of all, that we were not behind. We may have studied some things that they hadn't, and they studied some things that we hadn't, but we didn't have any problems, for example, in mathematics, arithmetic, it would be properly called. We didn't have any problems there. You may have missed a topic, and you had to make it, you had to learn it, but you felt like you were up. And in many cases, you were way ahead, because when I went in there in the sixth grade, I had been studying eighth grade stuff in some cases, because I was ready for it. And so I listened in on what she was teaching the 8th grade kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was pretty nice. But you really learned, what you learned in going to the school in town then was how to socialize with a whole bunch of other kids. And it was a whole different atmosphere. We had school plays at Mount Glen, but that's nothing like doing a school play in a classroom with 30 kids in your same class or 25 kids in your same class. And what you do on the playground is, you know, you learn to mix with each other and to deal with quite a variety of kids. Marbles were big, though, at either school. You played a lot of marbles.
Hmm.
And you packed your marbles to school, and you had different kinds of marble games. And sometimes you draw a circle in the dirt, and you put marbles in the middle, and you take turns trying to shoot them out, and you'd have, one that you'd use to shoot at the others. And we call them steelies. Sometimes they were steel mm-hmm. ball bearings, you know. And sometimes you dig a little hole in the ground. Everybody put one or two or three marbles in there, and you throw at it and try to get your marble into that hole. And if you did, you'd win. And we had rules that made it fair. So
everyone had a bag of marbles.
Everybody had a bag of marbles. Yeah, mm-hmm. You'd pack some, and usually you take them. And you had a little bag you put in your pocket, and you might decide to take 20 marbles that day to school. And sometimes you'd lose.
Mm-hmm.
I've still got marbles around here somewhere. I guess our kids maybe have used them too, but mm-hmm. there's still marbles around here from those days.
So and was it a bag that was made out of fabric or
anything that you could find, or you get your mother to make, or mm-hmm. if you're lucky, somebody would have a buckskin bag or something like that.
Oh,
but yeah, it'd be a variety of bags that you would use, but soft sided, mm-hmm. yeah. And I have marbles that are left over from my dad. Dad's day as a kid, they were actually, some of them were out of clay, and I think I still have those somewhere that would date out of the early 1900s, and those probably were old then. I would guess they're probably well over 100 years old.
Hmm.
But the teacher then, you would have one teacher in a class in Greenwood, but they would also have others come in for certain things, so that's where you start getting music lessons. So I started on the clarinet and and there was a teacher that came around in the schools in LeGrand, and they'd come to Greenwood, for example, one day a week, and they'd give music lessons on woodwind instruments. And then some other teacher would come around and do string instruments. And somebody else would come around and do horns. And so you could choose which one you want. You didn't have to, but if you wanted to, there was this one period each week that you could get out of your class, whatever, I don't know what it was, but then you could do this other thing. And so I took clarinet lessons that way and stayed with it up through my sophomore year in college, and then, sophomore year in high school, and then dropped out of that. And I wouldn't even be able to get a note out of a clarinet today. But you also had, there was some choir, because you'd have a special music teacher come around and you'd do choir maybe 2 hours a week or two 30-minute periods a week. And so you'd have those extra opportunities. Also, there were some teachers who were better at teaching math than others. So usually there'd be a teacher that would teach the fifth, sixth, and seventh grade math. So you got better instruction in some of those disciplines. Same way sometimes with English, there were some teachers, and they kind of figured out internally in that school, like at Greenwood, what teachers would do what teachers would teach each subject. But it wasn't a lot of trading around. You probably had your homeroom, what I'll call homeroom teacher, 50-65% of the time. Mm-hmm. 70%
did you come to school on a bus?
Rode a bus. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when we started riding the bus in 1945, because that's when it might have been starting the seventh grade. I'll double check that when we proofread this, but we had to ride what we called the Tiger Bus. And LeGrand High School, the Tigers, they had a team bus. It was actually a pretty nice bus. Now, remember, this is after the Second World War. It's a pre-Second World War bus, but there was lots of knee room. There was high seat backs. They were soft. And I remember enjoying riding that Tiger Bus. So they'd use it as a school bus during the week, and then for weekends they would use it to take the athletic teams to their contests in communities around, in Pendleton or Baker or wherever, the Hermiston, wherever they traveled to. Well, then about a year of that, and pretty soon they decided they didn't want to wear that bus out that way, and they started buying what are really no different than the classical school bus today. Uncomfortable seats, close together, and no room for anybody that's, once you hit about 150 pounds and 5'10", there's just no room. And I remember by the time I got out of high school, I was probably 6'1" and 190 pounds, and there was just no room for you in the seat, especially if there needed to be two people in that seat. It was, always thought it was miserable. We rode the bus, though. The bus route took about 30, let's see, we get on the bus about 7:45, and we get into school about 8:30. It took about 45 minutes, I guess. It was a school bus route, and there were other bus routes by then. But one of the two first bus routes, one of them went out Mount Glen Road and went out to what we call the Butte, which goes down Whittle Lane. We came back in on what's now, I think, called Webster Road or something. And we come back in past Gary Webster would be picked up, for example, and the Flanagans were along there. And we picked up the McDonald's, stopped at McDonald's and picked up somebody there. And came back up Pierce Road and picked up the Ramies, and I'm missing a lot of names too, and then come back in to town. I must have been a 30-35 mile route or something like that. Then there was another one went out towards the east in the Hot Lake area and out that direction as far as Little Grand School District went. We'd ride that school bus. You'd have a few, there was always, the bus driver would have a problem watching the kids because once in a while you could end up with a fight on the bus or something. Of course, winter time would be fun because you get stuck, and then the neighbor, you'd have to go to the nearest neighbor and get them to get their tractor out and pull you out, and all that sort of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, was there a middle school at that
time? There was called junior high, and in LeGrand, all of the kids went, there was no kindergarten in LeGrand except at Ackerman. And I don't know how long ago Ackerman had a kindergarten, but a long time ago. In the 40s, I'm not sure, but I know in the 50s it did. But anyway, there was grades 1 through 7 in the elementary schools. Mm. And then grade 8 was by itself. Mm. And grade 8 was the old central school, which is no longer there, but it was located where the current middle school is. Mm. It was the building that was torn down to put the current middle school there. That was the old central school But by the time I got there, the eighth grade was on the first floor of it. Basement was cafeteria and physical plant. First level was the eighth grade, and the upper level was actually an elementary school.
Hmm.
And that's where Central Elementary was the top floor of that building. And then about 1950, after I graduated high school in 51, and about 52, they built the current Central Elementary School. And then that building became entirely eighth grade.
What was the rationale for having just eighth graders?
Well, they didn't think eighth graders belonged in the elementary school. They didn't have room for them. So it was a way of handling it. And then they moved, and eventually as time went by, then ninth grade was moved in with the eighth grade. And so you had a junior high school. That went on for a number of years. And then they discovered that you didn't need ninth graders with all their hormones beginning to develop and wanting to do, you know, just interested in different things. And ninth graders belonged with high school kids, not with eighth grade kids.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so when I was on the school board in the 1970s, we made the decision to move the ninth grade into the high school and added on to the high school in the 70s, and we could move the ninth grade into that environment, and it became a middle school. The new building became eighth grade, seventh and eighth grade middle school. And you moved the seventh grade out of the elementary school, and that was more just to make room for kids in the elementary schools than it was to get the seventh graders out of the middle school.
When did you become interested in science?
Well, I had a chemistry set as a kid, and I probably had one of those from, I'm just going to guess, I don't remember what would have been available during the Second World War, but I'm sure I had to acquire my first one somehow during the Second World War, whether it was a used one or what, I don't know. Eventually, I do know that I was given for Christmas a new Gilbert chemistry set. I just loved playing with that stuff and making things, and it was just, you just recipes, you know, you just followed the procedures. But I had a lot of fun with it and just kind of enjoyed it. And it was, science always came easy, math always came easy for me. I lucked out and had really good math instructors, except for 1 year in high school, once I was in the wrong math class. I took ninth grade arithmetic, and I should have not been in there. I should have been in ninth grade algebra. I thought I needed to learn more arithmetic, and it was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers, ninth grade teacher recommended I take algebra, and I said, nah, I think I can learn some more math in ninth grade arithmetic. And I ended up, well, essentially, helping other students in class was good for me, but I didn't learn much math, and so it left me a little behind. And when I got to college, I had to catch up some algebra that I didn't have, but mm-hmm. it worked out all right. But
what are some of your best high school memories?
Well, it was a fun time. I never participated in athletics because we rode the school bus, and it just didn't seem to work out. And I suppose the one sport I would have enjoyed participating in and would have been basketball. And I probably could have. I was never real athletic and never fast or anything, but really kind of understood the basketball game and pretty well. And my brother and I used to play a lot of basketball one-on-one on our hayloft in the barn. We had a basket out in the barn, and we made a point of getting the hay fed out in the middle of the hayloft where we had the basket. That was the first hay we fed out in the wintertime. And we could we started with maybe a chunk that was 6 foot wide, you know, and pretty soon it widened out if you had a little decent room. And so we did a lot of shooting at baskets in the wintertime. We had just one little dull light in the ceiling there, but you could see enough to see the basket. And so we played a lot of basketball and got to be able to shoot pretty well in just one-on-one. So I kind of enjoyed basketball, but never did it beyond PE. The coach tried to get me to come out, but it just wasn't going to work out and be a farm kid and ride the bus and stuff like that. I was very interested in activities like student offices, so I was in a variety of those. I was, for example, I was the eighth grade president the second half. You did two presidents, you had two sets of officers in the eighth grade. So you give more kids a chance to experience that. And I got elected the eighth grade president for the last half of the school year. And that kind of helped get me started. I, don't remember how much in elementary school I was involved in that sort of thing, as in plays. But anyway, I don't remember what office I had in class, in a freshman or sophomore class. I did serve as the student body vice president during my sophomore year, got elected to that, and I was, I guess that would have been during the junior year. And then during the senior year, I ran for the president, lost out to the senior class athlete. I gave him a pretty good race, but I came in second. And the person that came in second was the student body manager, which turned out to be a really valuable experience for me because the principal was good enough to let me help out a lot. And so I was involved with ticket sales and keeping track of the income from ticket sales for all the varsity games and things like this. And so I was given a lot of responsibility, and it was just a great, great learning experience for me. And of course, when I was, I guess I must have been vice president though as a sophomore. As a junior, yeah. Okay, during my junior year, I guess, when I was vice president, that makes sense, that the vice president junior. I got to run a lot of the student body meetings because the president was an athlete and gone quite a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so, and that would have been another senior. It's always a senior that was student body president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's probably still that way today.
Mm-hmm.
But so I got to handle a lot of the meetings, and that's where I first started really getting involved in group activities where you were in front of a large group.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed that kind of thing.
That was the start of your leadership.
Start of my leadership kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed, I had a choice of taking English or journalism, and I chose to be in journalism and be a member of the student newspaper, Tiger Highlights, and did that for like a half a year, and then I thought I better get back into English because I didn't want to go into college, and it was always assumed that my brother and I would go to college, and we grew up thinking you didn't finish until you finished, and you didn't quit school until you got out of college, got a bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so it never went through our mind that we weren't going to go get a college degree. And so I was worried about my background in English and literature and going on to college, and so I took a half a year of I think journalism, and then a half a year of senior English.
Do you remember any of your favorite teachers?
Oh yeah, there were quite a few of them. One of them was Betty Ragsdale, who still is living in LeGrand, and she was our freshman English teacher. And Norma Mager is gone now, but she was the math teacher in eighth grade. And Pauline Johnson was an English teacher in the eighth grade. And she still lives and we're in contact with her occasionally. She and her husband Don actually were mink ranchers here. And she was teaching school. He was in the Second World War, and they didn't start mink until after that. But they had a mink farm out in the Somerville area for years. But she was an English teacher. Roy Butcher was a math teacher and a very, very good one and taught most of the high school math. Helen Quinn, Bob Quinn's wife, Quinn Coliseum's named after Bob Quinn. His wife Helen taught high school math. I didn't really have her very much. I had her as a substitute teacher, but she was a really good teacher, but I didn't really have her on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones, I guess, that jump out the most.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure, at least one other person, Cliff Exley, who taught PE and I think like maybe ninth grade social studies or something, but I had him as a PE teacher, and I really enjoyed him because I wasn't a great athlete. I mean, athletically, I didn't do all that great. He appreciated the fact that I tried.
Can you spell his last name?
A-E-X-L-E-Y.
Okay.
And he actually retired from teaching school. He's gone now, too. But he would be a person that would be named, I think, by quite a few students as really and having enjoyed him. Another one that was, I didn't have her as a teacher, but was a favorite of all of the women, and that was Mary Bennett. And Mary was here from 1945 to 1950, And I remember that because she was just here for an all-school reunion, all-class reunion for LeGrand High School just Saturday. And she came back for our reunion, our 50th reunion a few years ago, 50th, in 2001. But Mary Bennett was just an absolute favorite of every girl in that high school that had class from her. I think she demanded a lot and expected a lot, but was fair, and you could talk to her, and she's just a person you can relate to. And I'm sure that the women felt like if they had a problem, if they wanted to go up to a pilot lady, they could go, and she'd give them the time. I don't know. My wife Arlene had her for PE teacher in high school, because Arlene came to LeGrand High School in 1948, so we've known each other since the fall of 48. But we didn't date steadily until we were seniors in college at Oregon State in 54, 55, and then got married in September of 55. But she would be one that the women would tell you. Mm-hmm. It was very much a favorite.
One thing that I wanted to ask you about that I forgot was on the ranch that you had, that your family had, was it just fruit that you were raising, or were you also raising animals or other kinds of crops besides that?
Well, the fruit was really the commercial crops. We did raise some wheat and some grains. We raised a little bit of wheat. We mostly raised barley and oats to feed the animals. And so we'd always have a few hogs around, primarily for our own use, but usually you raised one or two extra you sold. You'd have a litter of hogs and you raise them and you'd sell some and you maybe butcher one or two. And we did home butcher at home. We always had at least two milk cows around, and that was because you never wanted to be out of milk. So you had to have, some of them would be dry part of the year when it was, you know, leading into calving.
Mm-hmm.
And so you always had two milk cows around, so you always had milk. And of course, part of the year you had two cows that were producing milk, and you had way more than you needed. And sometimes, I mean, we probably had three milk cows. We always had at least two or three beef-type animals around. We mostly bred the milk cows to a beef animal, and that gave us a calf that you could butcher and have pretty good beef.
Mm-hmm.
But if we didn't, we might buy a beef animal, a beef calf, and raise it. But we never raised beef commercially beyond maybe one or two here and there because of the way things went mm-hmm. together. We also always had horses around. My dad enjoyed having a team of horses, and so the horses that he had in the ice business, when he got out of it in 1935, he kept that team around, and then from one of those raised two foals out of one of those. Her name was Flossie, and so raised two horses out of her, and so we had a team of horses around up in through the 50s. And so I grew up knowing how to work a team of horses. And we would actually use horses on the wagon, on the hay wagon, for example, and go out in the hay field to bring in loose hay, and we'd pitch it onto the hay wagon. And it was an old iron-tired wagon. It was would look not unlike covered wagons in terms of the running gear.
So you had chores when you got home?
Oh yeah, we had chores. And you'd pitch the loose hay onto the wagon, and somebody'd be on the wagon stacking the hay, so you'd have to fit it out into the corner so you could haul as much as you could. And so we just team of horses for that, and that worked really well, because you wouldn't have to drive them, you just tell them to pull up and tell them to stop and things like that. And so two people on the ground pitching from each side, one person on the load pushing hay around, getting it located. Mm-hmm. And also you had to stack the hay on the wagon the right way, because when you put the hay in the hay mow, use what's called a Jackson fork, and it's a great big fork looking thing that's made out of wood and steel, and it's usually got at least four tines on it, maybe five or six, and the tines are probably 3 foot long and slightly curved, and you set them into the hay in a way and cock it that it picks it up with a derrick and a horse on the other end. If the other end of the barn goes up through the hay mow and you pull it, it's a device, a mechanical device. It goes up and then tracks into the barn, and then when you want the hay to dump, you pull a rope and it trips it, and it causes the fork to tip. The fork is curved, So when it goes up, the curve, the teeth are curved enough that it just picks up the loose hay, takes it with it.
Oh.
And when it gets up into the hay mow, goes up and hits the runner up there and goes into the hay mow, then you could pull a rope that you fed up with it, and it trips it, and it lets the fork tip down and lets the hay slide off. So the guy in the hay mow is telling you when to trip it. Saying, "Tripper." Mm-hmm. And of course, then the guy on the horse needs to hear that too, because he needs to stop, and you back the horse up and start all over again.
So this was your brother and your father and you that would do it?
And my uncle. So
and your
four
uncle.
Of us. Yeah.
Now your uncle had a house on the place too?
No, he just lived with, my folks. He lived upstairs. He had a room in the house, and he never married, and so he always farmed with my dad.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of things you did in the summertime and things like that. Yeah.
Were there a lot of rural kids coming into the high school, and you have the kind of the same stories about having to be home for chores or getting up? Did you get up early?
Didn't have to. No, we were. Some did, but we didn't. My brother and I lucked out that our dad would let us sleep in until we had to get up to get on the school bus.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really have any morning chores to speak of, unless unusual situation when some of the family were gone and we might have to go milk the cows or something. But we had evening chores. I mean, somebody always, you kind of rotated around. It wasn't necessarily you had to do this thing every night. But get in the wood, you know, split the wood and bring it in for the fires. We had until in the 40s, we had a kitchen, old kitchen wood stove to cook on. There was a heating stove in the front room until after the Second World War, when we got a furnace about 1948. So by the time, by then I was, you know, 16 years old is when we gave up the wood. Out there are cows to milk, and it isn't that we milk a cow every night or cows every night. We just help out. Our parents were pretty good about making sure that we had study time and we had some time to ourselves. And so we weren't overwhelmed by chores. Even though some kids on farms were, mm-hmm. we weren't. But you were expected to have something, to do something every evening. And mm-hmm. so filling the wood box was something that pretty much between my brother and myself, we got that done. Make sure this kindling's off and it's in place. Make sure there's wood chopped for the cook stove versus my dad always had a small cook stove. He always had when they got rid of the big cook stove and got an electricity, then he always had what we called a trash burner. But it was essentially a stove about 12, 14 inches wide, and it had a cooktop on it, but it had two lids instead of the usual four or six or something. And he actually plumbed it with a pipe, so the water from the hot water tank ran through that stove. So in the winter time, when you had a fire in that, and he usually had a fire in there all day long in the winter because it helped heat the kitchen. It was the only heat in the kitchen except what came in from the front room on the big stove in there. And so it would help heat the hot water even after we had electric hot water heater. So the cold water would go through that kitchen stove, and if it happened to be burning, then if he preheated it there, then it went into the electric hot water heater and finished off if it needed any. So the electric heater didn't have to run as much as it would have otherwise. Yeah.
What about your mom? What kinds of things would she be doing around the farm?
Well, she really was the person that took care of the home, took care of washing the clothes, having all the meals, doing all the canning, those sorts of things. And it takes a lot of time to do all those things. Also, she's the one that kept the books for the ranch when we, you know, whether it was the books to keep track of how much you sold in peddling or selling the local fruit or the fruit that went off to the cannery or packing plants or whatever. And she's the one that kept track of all the pickers and how much each day we'd weigh all of the cherries picked by each person and record it. They had their little tickets they put in a box, and you'd weigh the box in the orchard and then you'd write it down. And at the end of the day, my mother would total it up, and then the next day we'd give a little ticket, we'd give a addition slip, a little slip back out of the adding machine that would show how many boxes the picker had picked the day before and how much each one weighed. And so if they wanted to dispute it, they thought they picked 10 boxes and we only chose 9, then we had to adjust for that and try to figure out what happened. And usually you just said, okay, it's 10 and here's your average and this is what we'll give you. Sometimes they tried it every day. Pretty soon you figured out they were trying to cheat you.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably weren't kept around very long at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd know that they had 10 and a half boxes, so if you showed one box on there kind of light, they'd say, yeah, that's right. And mostly we didn't have problems with that.
So they get paid every day?
They get paid, well, not every day, but you'd record this every day, and the next day you'd take the slip back to them. So the next day they'd get the check the day before and see if it's a problem or not. Once they accepted the slip and didn't and said it was okay, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't come back 6 days later and say, well, really. And then they varied. Some of them, a few of them might be wanting to be paid almost every day, but we didn't want to do that, so we didn't really ask pickers back to have to be paid every day. It was usually expected to pay maybe once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And or maybe lots of them only got paid like two times during the whole season.
Mm-hmm.
And they had enough, they earned enough money, they were well enough off, they could live without having to be paid so often.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them wouldn't collect their money until we were done.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have one check and that'd be it.
Mm-hmm.
But she took all that, all the house cleaning and all the phone calls. People are always calling to order, you know, fruit and things like this. And so she keeps track of that. And people coming to the door and things like this. And so you just deal with all of that and kind of mm-hmm. keeping track of where everybody was. And
what was her social life like? Did she have friends?
Well, she did have friends, and she belonged to a couple of social clubs. So once, about twice a month, she would go to those. Each one met once a month. And in fact, that's documented in her oral history. One of them was called the Kind Deeds Club, and another one I called the Out Home Club. I'm not sure what that was, but mm-hmm. her oral history documents that, and she would do that on a regular basis. And they had friends, they belonged, and in later years, the Farm Bureau started, and they belonged to Farm Bureau, and they were active in it, and those Farm Bureau met once a month in potlucks, and I remember going to those. In fact, after Arlene and I were married, we belonged to the Farm Bureau, and went to a lot of those potlucks for a few years. So you did things like that. They went to several national meetings of the Farm Bureau. One they went to, I remember, was Chicago, for example, and they'd go with others. And Sundays, often on Sunday afternoons, we'd go to a relative's house and have Sunday dinner, and they'd come to our house and things like this. And
but did your family go to church? Sometimes. Did you have...
not in the 40s, but my brother and I went to the Methodist church in the 40s because the neighbors were going to the Methodist church on Sundays. And so we rode in with them and went to the Hendricks Methodist Church, which is still a building down on Fur Street, and it's North Fur. This building is still there. It's no longer a church. It's privately owned. It's where the Salvation Army was up until a few years ago. And we attended that for a few years because the neighbors were going there, and so we got some religious education there. And then in the later 40s, probably about 47 or something, then we started going to the Christian Science Church in LeGrand, and attended that then from there on.
Would you talk a little bit about the Christian Science Church at that time?
Well, it's in the same building that it has been until recently when we had to close it. The membership was never large, but a lot more members than we had when we closed. It's a church that as part of church, you don't have social activities.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a kitchen in there, and you don't do, you don't have potlucks and things like this. You have your Wednesday night church service, which is partly reading from what we call the textbook by Mary Baker Eddy, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, and also reading from the King James Version of the Bible. And you read from the Bible and then you read corollary text from the textbook as authored by Mary Baker Eddy. And then you open it for people to make individual comments that they want to make to the congregation. Their experiences that may be often, usually it's related to his religious experiences or healings that they've had or something like that, or where they felt that they've been led in a certain way by through prayer. And then Sunday services are composed of two readers reading, one from the Bible and one from the Science and Health again. And those lessons are actually put out by the Central Church for us in Boston, Massachusetts, which in Christian Science you call the Mother Church. And it's a large facility in Boston. It is very well known in the Boston area. It's a very large, beautiful church, landscaped around and fountains and things like this outside mm-hmm. and things like this. And
now, did your whole family?
Whole family, yes. My family got into Christian Science through my father. Actually, my grandmother Young, yeah, around the turn of the century, and by this around 1900, long in there, 1902-3, my grandfather Young was having all kinds of problems, and the doctors thought it was his heart, and they didn't feel like there was anything they could do for him. And they said, we've essentially don't have anything else that we know of in those days to do for him. And so my grandmother Young thought, well, here, you know, she's got kids that are like 2 years old on up to maybe 20 years old, but here's some little ones that are coming along, and what's going to happen? And so she really was trying to figure out how to heal him, and so she talked to a friend. The friend said, well, maybe you thought of Christian Science. She said, Christian Science, what's that? So this friend loaned her this book, Science and Health, and she started reading it, and she got help from a practitioner, and so my grandfather was healed, and in fact, he lived another 25 years after that. He died when he was 28, I guess he was 86 or something like that when he died. Right. Yeah. So, and so the kids were all in their 20s. The youngest ones were in their 20s when he died instead of being babies. At the time he was ill, my dad was probably 4 or 5 years old, and my uncle, the youngest one, the Johnny, the one that worked with my dad, would have been 2 years old or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he was older. He was born in, he was born, I think I'm right, 1846. 44 keeps coming into my mind, but it's in 1846. And he died, and the youngest was born in 1901, so he was 55 years old when the youngest child was born, but he was also 34 years old when he was married. Because in those days, fellows didn't marry as young because they couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. So they had to work a lot of years, and then they could afford a family. And so then they would marry a younger woman. So it was not unusual for a woman to be 10 to 15 or even 20 years younger than the fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And so my grandmother was, I think she was probably 15 years younger than he was at least.
Do you know how the Christian Science Church in LeGrand began?
No, I don't. I just know that it located where it is now in the, well, by 1916 or something like that. There's some church history there, but how it came to be, I don't know. But the way it typically happened was that it happened to really spread from the East Coast because a few people learned about Mrs. Eddy in this book and the healing work that she was doing, and so they'd want to study under her, and so mm-hmm. she then would take them on as students, just a few people, and so she would take them on as students, and it began to expand from there, and of course those people then would teach others
mm-hmm.
and pretty soon there were a few people around the United States and around the world that were students of Christian Science that were teaching others.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who decide they want to be teachers of Christian Science, and so that's what they also become practitioners first, and then they become teachers if they choose to.
So the reading room is no longer there.
And the reading room is no longer there. Yeah, you need a church to support the reading room, mm-hmm. and that's back one of the church requirements that our main church in Boston is to have. There needs to be a church in the community to support the reading room. Mm-hmm. If there isn't a church, then you should not have a reading room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to at the end of your high school years,
mm-hmm.
Your decision about which school to go to and what you decided.
Well, in high school, like today, there were schools, but universities and colleges that would come around and tell you about their schools. Not as organized as it is today, but you would be contacted, and I'm not sure of how that was organized as far as the school district is concerned. I don't know whether, like Reed College, whether they wrote to the school district and said, "Can we send somebody up?" or how organized it was. But I remember considering Reed College, for example, as an option, and I they want, if I had good enough grades, if that was, if they would like to have had me come down there, but tuition would have been a lot more. And I'm not sure that at that point I was ready to really move away from this valley for 9 months out of the year. And especially when you go off of a farm and do that, as compared to maybe living in town and doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember then talking to people from Eastern Oregon College of Education at that time. It had changed from Eastern Oregon Normal School to Eastern Oregon College of Education. And going to a day at, on the campus where a visitor's day where you could go and kind of talk to some of the instructors and meet a few other students and find out about different programs. But I remember in high school, I always thought of myself as being a math or a science-oriented person. I never wanted to particularly be a writer, for example, or taking college work in English didn't particularly turn me on. I knew that I didn't want to be a musician, but science and math came pretty easily for me, and it seemed kind of a natural area to stay with. And so that was always something I wanted to do. I actually ended up thinking I wanted to be a chemical engineer by the time I started at Eastern Oregon College of Education at that time in 1951, and had some good instructors.
What did the campus look like at that time?
Well, it pretty primitive compared to today. At that time, Enloe Hall was called the administration building, and it was the main building on campus. There was also Ackerman was there, and it was an elementary school at that time. And the library had been finished in the spring of 1951. The current library, Pierce Library, has an addition on it, the big reading room on the north there. But it's had two additions, I think, in the last 50 some years. But the library was there by 1951, by the spring of 1951. And that's about it. The gym there by Eckerman was there, and that Quonset Hut was there. And then Hunt Hall was there, and Hunt Hall and Dorian were part of that L that is still there. And so the north wing was Hunt, and that south wing was Dorian.
Mm-hmm.
And Dorian was for the women, and Hunt was for the men. And the food service area was in the middle. And don't think you could get between the two without going outside or going through the food service area.
Mm-hmm.
They really kept people separated in those days and tried to.
So you moved on campus.
And so, no, but I lived at home.
Oh, you lived at home.
And I lived at home, and by then, of course, my brother and I I would drive to campus, and we drove to school our senior year. We pretty much got to drive to school, too, a lot of the time. We rode the bus part of the time, but we got to drive a car to something.
Mm-hmm.
And in those, we actually had a Jeep. Our dad bought a Willie's Jeep, a 1946 Willie's Jeep. It was, the first Jeep bought in this valley that was made for the that was non-military Jeep. It was actually made for this public Jeep, to sell to the public rather than sell to the military.
Mm-hmm.
But it was patterned after the Jeep that was developed for the Second World War, and the only real difference probably was a little painted a little different color, and they made a they put a power takeoff on the rear of it so you could run farm equipment with it. Like if you wanted to pull something like a rake that needed the power takeoff or a mowing machine, you could do that. And so we actually had that. In fact, my brother still owns that Jeep from 1946. As far as we know, it's the first non-military Jeep in this valley.
Mm.
It has a gear shift on the column, which I've never seen another one like it, but there are some around, but not many.
Mm.
But anyway, we got to drive that during our senior year at the school. And then we continued to drive either that or some other vehicle and go to college. And so drove in every day and went to college that way. I actually enrolled in pre-chemical engineering. And so for the first 2 years here, I was essentially a pre-chemical engineer, which meant you took all of the pre-engineering courses the college offered. You also took math courses for 2 years. You took 2 years of this. And you took 2 years of chemistry, I did, and I took a year of physics, and where I met Ralph Bagley's instructor was I took general physics from him and also calculus from him, and that's how I knew him as an instructor. But I just had a fantastic preparation for junior college kind of preparation. And so when I got down to Oregon State, it was not a problem.
Hmm.
I the problem would have been, and of course I didn't have any background in, I haven't taken here. I got into some biology, some botany courses that, you know, I didn't have a basic biology background, so I had to work pretty hard in some of those. But when it came to engineering and chemistry and math and stuff, you know, I don't want to be a piece of cake, but I felt like I was prepared.
So how long were you at Oregon State?
I spent 2 years at Oregon State, graduated in 1955. Actually, I decided at the end of my fall term as a junior, I realized that I didn't want to become a chemical engineer. And the rationale for that was that I found out that chemical engineers in those days, in the 50s when they graduated, could only find jobs east of the Mississippi River. They told me in 1950, well, probably in the winter of 1954, probably January 1954 or something, maybe December 53, they told me that, hey, when you graduate, or right now, this coming year, this spring of 54, we only know of one engineering job on the East Coast in chemical engineering. That'll be hiring into. Now, whether that's right or wrong, there's very few.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, what am I going to do? I don't want to have to go to New Jersey to be an engineer. So I changed over and became a horticulture major.
Oh.
And it was very easy to do that because you had to do coursework that required a strong science background. And so soils and things like that were very easy for me. I continued to take some engineering courses because I enjoyed them. So I took things like strength and materials and automotive mechanics and steam, air, and gas power and surveying, you know, civil surveying and things like this. But I just took the minimum to get a degree in horticulture. I mean, the minimum horticulture courses.
And you married Arlene along the way?
And so we then started dating seriously in the fall of 1954, and then were married the following September.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I graduated in June of 55, and we were married in the first September of 55, and then I got drafted into the Navy. And we knew that that might happen, because those days, most people were getting drafted after they got out of college. And I had deferments in order to finish school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was drafted in December of 55 and spent nearly 2 years in the Navy. And I told them I wanted to go to the Army because I didn't swim very well. But they decided that the Navy ran the receiving station up in Boise. And they were skimming off all the college graduates up there and sent them to the Navy because the Navy drafted, the only peacetime draft in the Navy that I'm aware of was November and December of 55. And I think February of 56. Normally they had more than enough people just from recruiting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Recruiting. But anyway, they sent us to boot camp in San Diego, went through boot camp there, ended up being assigned aboard a ship, a tanker. They're called fleet oilers. They're very large ships. They're nearly as long as an aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. What you carry is all of the different kinds of fuel that are needed for ships at sea. So you carried bunker fuel for the ships. That's what they burn. It's a real heavy, thick oil. It hardly runs without being hot. In fact, it doesn't. It's almost tar-like when it's cold. You carry aviation fuel. You carry jet plane fuel. Plane fuel is kind of like kerosene. And we also had a big enough freezer we'd carry some extra food. So ships would come alongside us at sea. Everything from transport ships to destroyers to destroyer escorts to battleships, cruisers, aircraft carriers, all of them would come alongside. And oftentimes you have one on each side of the ship. You're going down, you know, traveling maybe at 15 knots, trying to keep headway, rough sea. You got ships on two sides of you that are only over there, you know, seemed like 10 feet, but they were probably over there 100 feet. And you always had to prepare for collision. So we had a collision warning kind of system. And if one ship lost steerage, you had to break apart, and there was a system for it. And so we would actually shoot a projectile across to the other ship, a brass projectile that was about a quarter inch in diameter, and it had a nylon line attached to it, and you'd use a cartridge to shoot it across and try to shoot it where nobody was. They'd get the nylon, it would be attached to a rope on our ship, and they called them lines, and they pull it across, and pretty soon if you've got a big enough rope across, you can pull a cable across, and then you'd use the cable on a big drum to keep it taut, and you'd run across this cable system, you'd run the big hoses, and some of the fueling, refueling hoses for bunker fuel, the fuel that the ships operated on, were probably 10 inches in diameter. They were huge things.
Wow.
And you'd run, you'd work on a slippery deck with the chains down and with a life jacket on. That was the most dangerous work I've ever had. I never did go in, but there'd always be a destroyer, destroyer escort following up in the rear in case we fell overboard.
Jeez, that's good. So yeah. when did you get back to?
So I had 2 years of that, and actually a little under, because they got rid of us in September. I went in December, and they got rid of us in September of 57 because we were undesirable. We weren't going to re-up and stay in the Navy, and they were hurting for the budget. So I got out in September of 57 and then worked on the ranch for a year and thought maybe I was going to go into the fruit raising business and realized that the ranch wasn't big enough for two families.
Oh,
and so then decided, what am we going to do? So then I went up to see Ralph Badgley, who I knew pretty well from my college days there, you know, and that. And by now, it's that's 6 years later after I had last probably talked to him, 53. And this is 58, so 5 years later. And I thought I probably had, I was so naive that I thought I had to, probably had to get a degree in education and maybe even teach in high school before I could teach in college.
Hmm.
And that's how naive, I think most, I don't think I was the only one, I think most of us probably were about that level. Bison wasn't anywhere near as good as it is today in terms of some aspects of it. I mean, getting a very broad, comprehensive understanding of what the real world is in terms of careers wasn't nearly as good as it is today. But anyway, found out from him, well, hey, if you want to teach in college, go get a master's degree in science. You didn't need a PhD in those days because they couldn't hire, there weren't enough PhDs. PhDs were skimmed off by the universities, the research institutions. So they were having to hire master's level people. So he said, you go get your master's and you'll be able to teach in college. So I said, that's what I want to do. And I was pretty certain, I felt very comfortable with it. I wanted to teach in college. And so we went off to Oregon State, and I got set up in a program. And in the fall of, in September of 1958, because I worked a year after the Navy, on the ranch. And so in September of 58, we moved to Corvallis, Arlene and I, and she got a job. And in the admissions office and something like that, or records office, registrar's office, I guess what it was. And so she essentially put me through school, and I didn't have any GI Bill at that time because those of us that were in the service in the armed forces in that period of time didn't have access to the Korean War Bill and the Second World War, of course, that was over. And so we didn't, and I'm not even sure there was a Korean War support at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there was no help, so and then borrowed some money from my folks. Actually, they even helped us out some without having to pay it back, because they said, well, your brother had 5 years of college, you've only had four, we'll help you some on that fifth year. So between their help and Arlene working full-time, made it through, and about halfway through that year, I got this letter in the mail, and it was like January, February, and this letter from the president of Eastern Oregon University, Frank Bennett. And it said something like, Jerry, if you want to teach, if you want a job here, you're going to have to fill out this application. Ralph Badgley had talked to him, because I had my conversation with Ralph, you know, that summer before. And so I filled it out and sent it in, and they sent a letter back and said, you're hired, and here's the salary.
Okay.
There was no negotiation, no nothing. I mean, I either could sign it or not. And I signed off, and the salary was $4,800.
Yeah.
And 1959.
Did that seem like a lot of money?
Well, no, but it seemed like enough.
Mm-hmm.
It was better than what they paid in the service, you know. and by the time I got here, the legislature, I guess, had given a little more money, so it went up to $5,000. So in 1959, my first year here at Eastern Oregon University, I got $5,000 for the year. And, you know, and you
was it called Eastern Oregon College at
Eastern
that time?
Eastern Oregon College of Education still at that time.
Still.
It didn't even, we'd have to look that up, but I don't think it became Eastern Oregon. It was EOCE, I'm sure, pretty sure, at that time. So I went through EOC, and but I had left before it became EOU. I had retired before it became
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
So I came and they said, we want you to teach mostly chemistry and we want you to teach a little bit of math and also some physical science survey, but I never did teach the physical science survey. They didn't need me for that. They needed me in chemistry and they needed me to teach a math class for 1 year. And so I did that and enjoyed the math a lot. And also enjoyed the chemistry, so I became a chemistry teacher then after that. But it was a great experience. It was an opportunity that I couldn't have had without being in a small college. I knew I wanted to teach in a small college,
mm-hmm.
whether I'd had the PhD or not. I knew I wanted to be in a small college atmosphere because I liked that one-on-one opportunity. But I thought I had finished my formal training when I came here in 59. I didn't think I'd ever go on to the doctorate. Took me about 3 years to figure out, hey, things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry, if you want to stay in higher ed, and I got tenure with my master's because they were doing that in those days. But and colleges all over the United States were doing that. These were all smaller colleges, not the universities, but small colleges were doing tenure with a master's. But I saw that, hey, you know, you're gonna get left in the dust if you don't go off and get that doctorate. So then. That's when I began the plan and we investigated and then I went back to Oregon State went back to Oregon State and spent 2 years down there. And I got a National Science Foundation Science Faculty Fellowship for the first year. And then the college was good enough to give me give me my sabbatical then pay the second year.
Oh, great.
So they went 1 year without having to pay me anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good for them because I could get the National Science Foundation, which was really nice because there was about I had to compete nationally, and there were about 300 people that got those nationally. And there were about five or six of us at Oregon State when I got down there, and that was kind of fun because we got acquainted mm-hmm. with each other. But anyway, and then in my second year, I had funds from the sabbatical, but that wasn't really enough for a family to live on. We had kids ranging in age from, you know, the youngest one was about 4 at that time, the oldest one was about 8 or 9, and then there were always college expenses, you know, books and all that sort of thing, and they did waive some of my tuition because I was a faculty member here, but then my major professor down there, Kai Wong, was good enough to find an assistantship for me from some federal funding he had, so I got that. And in fact, I was going to get some other funding. I was going to get was actually there was some federal dollars because of my being in the Navy that were available, but it didn't pay very much, and so he could get me an assistantship that paid better than that. And so we had that to help us out. So we got through those 2 years all right.
Yeah.
And then came back and. Faced all my coursework, did all of my research, and then came back and spent the year of 68-69. That was 66-68, we were down there. Then came back, and from 68-69, I spent that year teaching a full load and also writing a dissertation. And it was tough. It really was.